I'm Tom Cooney, and this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Elizabeth Edwards. Elizabeth is the founder of Cincinnati Innovates, and Elizabeth, it's hard to believe, but I guess you're coming on your fifth anniversary of Cincinnati Innovates?
That's right. 5 years of innovation in Cincinnati.
For people who aren't aware of it, just give us a brief description of what Cincinnati Innovates actually is.
Yeah, so Cincinnati Innovates is a regional innovation competition, and it runs every summer, usually from May through the middle of July. We put up about $100,000 in grant awards for entrepreneurs at the very early stages. So it could be the idea stage, you know, prototype stage, and really any kind of innovation or startup idea. So we see things that are products, that are fashion. We've seen home cooking services. It really runs the gamut. But we also get a lot of really high-tech innovations coming from Children's, coming from UC, and coming from the greater community. And that's really the point. The competition was founded 5 years ago by about 20 sponsors in the entrepreneurial community who serve entrepreneurs, because we wanted to create a way for all of the existing organizations that help entrepreneurs connect with people who have ideas. So the people out there in Cincinnati that have ideas would know about these great organizations that provide funding and help write business plans and help with advisory services.
And I've been to your event several times, and it's fascinating to me to go and to hear some of the ideas that these people have.
It's really exciting. Every year it's something new. This year I have a couple that I'm really excited about. One is called MapSwing. It's a product that is for your iPad or iPhone, and basically it helps you improve your driving range practice. So if you're out there on the driving range, how do you know if you're improving or if you're getting worse? And practice to practice, how do you compare? And this app helps you do that.
I may not want to have that app because I have a feeling I'm not going to like the answer. You've had a number of winners over the last several years, some of which are still have ended up going into a business as a result of developing their idea, presumably partly because of the grant they won.
Absolutely. One that actually is having an event this week called Foxfire, and it's a really cool business. It's basically glow-in-the-dark on steroids, and this is a hyper-photoluminescent technology that an account executive with Eli Lilly, who's also happens to be a volunteer firefighter, had discovered just in the course of his volunteer firefighter duties, and thought, you know what, one of the big safety problems for firefighters is that they're in dark, smoky environments, and battery-powered lights aren't necessarily the best thing to take into fires. So he created this product that allows firefighters to see their way and to identify fallen firefighters and get out safely.
Elizabeth, if people would like more information about Cincinnati Innovates, where can they contact you?
Well, if you go to www.cincinnatiinnovates.com, you can see all the information about the competition all 5 years. We have archived entries there, links to past winners. You can find out more information about the workshops that we have on intellectual property, on branding and financing.
Thanks for listening to BusinessWise. I'm Tom Cooney with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney, and this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Elizabeth Edwards. Elizabeth is the founder of Cincinnati Innovates. And Elizabeth, you're about to have your fifth event for Cincinnati Innovates. Where is it and when is it?
It's on August 22nd at Northern Kentucky University at the Digitorium, which if you haven't been to the Digitorium, it's a very cool space. And we will be announcing our winners for this year. And actually, you can see all of the entrants online at www.cincinnatiinnovates.com. And this year, we're giving out 7 different awards. And actually, there's one special award this year that will be announced later because it launched on July 22nd. And it'll run for 45 days on Innocentive. And this is an EPA water challenge. And so this year, it's interesting. It's the fifth anniversary of Cincinnati Innovates, but much more importantly, it's the 100th anniversary of the EPA in Cincinnati. And we actually have one of the largest water technology research institutions in the world right here in Cincinnati. It's across the campus of UC in Clifton. And so this year, the EPA is putting up a $10,000 water challenge. And if you're interested, you can go to innocentive.com/EPA. And that's where you can compete for that award.
Over the years that you've had this competition, some of these ideas have grown into businesses. Do you have any statistics on what some of the successes have been?
It really runs the gamut because we have people of all different stages who are entering. So it's kind of hard to say from year to year, now are they successful? I think if you're an entrepreneur at the idea stage and the prototype stage, and you're still trying, that's one measure of success. But we definitely have a lot of companies, winners, finalists, and people that, you know, weren't even finalists. I wish we had more than 10 awards to give out every year. But we've had companies like Zach Green that I mentioned yesterday. Zach Green's company now has, I think, something like 12 employees, $2 million in revenue. He just raised $1 million in venture capital. I mean, that's really a standout one. We have high-tech companies like Gamma Dynamics. That was one of our first winners. And they're going on to work with, you know, some of the biggest technology companies in the world on their electrofluidic displays. But then we have companies that have, and, you know, similarly high-tech, really long lead times. So when you think of the amount of time that it takes for a medical device to make its way from idea to marketplace, it's years. But we have a lot of entrants that, you know, I can proudly say are still working on their concepts. They're going down the pathway of commercialization, patenting, doing their clinical trials, raising venture capital. And then others that are smaller businesses that are, you know, still doing really well. We had a winner last year, My Backpack Tags, really cool business. Two moms coming together to say, you know what? There's got to be a better way to keep track of where our kids are going after school. And they developed a system for school principals.
It is interesting how people can come up with such varied business ideas, some of which make a lot of sense when you hear it and you're thinking, why didn't I think of that?
Right.
Well, Elizabeth, if people want more information about Cincinnati Innovates or mm-hmm. the upcoming event, where should they go?
www.cincinnatiinnovates.com.
Well, Elizabeth, thanks for your information and thanks for all you're doing for the Cincinnati entrepreneurial community. For BusinessWise, I'm Tom Cooney. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, I'm happy to say that the May 1st deadline has come and gone, and certainly as parents of a senior daughter headed to college, that gives us some level of relief.
And now it's on to the next thing, which is not relieving, which is paying for the cost of college.
And many parents now are wondering, how are we going to pay for the college that our child has just chosen? And hopefully they're not saying that. Hopefully they've talked about that in advance. But for those parents who don't have the cash resources to pay for the tuition completely, student loans, college loans are certainly something that many people will take advantage of.
Yes, and the key is that you take advantage of them, they don't take advantage of you, because a lot of people have problems with college loan debt. In fact, I think I read a statistic that 41% of college loans go delinquent at some time during the first 5 years after graduation.
One thing I've learned through this entire process is the ability to get a college loan, a student loan, is just way too easy. And there's really no balance between the amount of college loan that you can take out versus the type of job and career that you're using those dollars to pay for. College loans, unfortunately, are used to pay for so many different things, including a student's vacation, living expenses, so forth. So you have to be very careful about how much money that you are borrowing and make sure that the career you're choosing is commensurate with the amount of money you're using to pay for it.
Like any credit, you need to make sure that you realize that just because you're able to borrow the money doesn't mean that you should borrow the money. And it doesn't mean that you can pay the loan back. It just means, really, for college loans, that you're using it for the purposes of college.
Not to sound like a CPA, but there really needs to be a return on the investment. So if you're borrowing those dollars to pay for an education, make sure that the education you're getting is going to be able to pay that loan back.
And make sure it's for education, as you mentioned, not a vacation or not just another means of funding a lifestyle while someone is in college.
And while the vast majority of the students do take out federal loans, many students fill that gap with private loans or non-federal loans, and those can be very problematic.
Generally, the government loans have some amount of flexibility in terms of repayment based on your income. So if you lose your job or don't have a high enough paying job after college graduation, you can usually get extended terms on the government loans, but the private loans don't have that same flexibility.
Right, and generally those private loans require a parent or a grandparent or another person to sign on them, co-sign with the student. And I'll tell you what, the bank or the lender is going to come right after that individual who's the co-signer. So be very careful when you take out non-federal loans, especially if you are a co-signer on that loan. And remember, neither the federal student loans or the private student loans are dischargeable in bankruptcy. You cannot get rid of that debt. Now, the federal student loans, you may be able to take certain public service jobs and minimize that debt, but clearly that's not the case for the private loans.
The bottom line is, it may make a lot of sense to take out a loan for college. Just use the loan proceeds wisely, use your college education wisely, and hopefully get a good job so that you can pay back those loans.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Summer days can be lazy and hazy days, but for many children, this is a great opportunity for them to make extra money and learn how to handle financial issues as well.
They may not perceive it that way, at least initially, but it is a great time to teach your kids about both about money and also inspiring entrepreneurship. For younger children who aren't old enough to get a formal job where they have a paycheck and report to work, it might be an opportunity to do odd jobs, cut lawns, deliver newspapers, whatever that might be.
Babysitting.
Yeah, and in essence, they're their own self-employed person at that point, even though they may be 14 or 15 years old.
When a child earns money, and they earn money because of their own efforts, it's really a great learning experience, because bottom line is they equate their own personal effort with being paid money. And then when you weave into that the fact that they may have expenses to pay, for example, if they dog sit or walk dogs and they're responsible for buying the doggy bag, the doo-doo bags, or when they mow people's lawns and they have to buy the tools and equipment that go along with that. Those are expenses that offset income. It's just a great opportunity for them to learn about owning their own business.
And I think you learn more about saving money when you have to work to earn the money. You're not quite as quick to spend it, or at least most people aren't.
As parents of teenager daughter, we understand how easy it is just to hand a child money when they ask for something. It's much more difficult to spend the time and have the conversation to make them realize that they need to have some skin in the game. How can they help earn some part of whatever it is that they're asking for and save for it?
One way to help them with that is to establish goals, maybe a suggestion about how much you should save out of your earnings, how much you should spend on, leisurely things like movies or whatever that you're going to spend kind of weekly. And maybe there's something you're saving for that's still a consumption item, but that costs more money, and maybe you can have a savings goal for that, for more of an intermediate need.
So like different pots that have different goals associated with them, and help them understand and separate those different earnings objectives. Don't forget one pot they need to consider, and that's the tax consequence. I'll never forget when our son was a teenager and he got his first paycheck, and he realized that the earnings weren't all there. He's like, what happened to my money? Why are we spending so much in taxes? Why is so much of it coming out in taxes? And that is quite an eye-opening experience for a child to realize that some of their hard-earned money goes to pay Uncle Sam. It is a conversation that must be had, because even if a child does have their own business, if they earn more than $400, they may not have to pay federal income tax, but they are required to pay Social Security and Medicare tax, which means they'll have to file a tax return and owe tax.
Now, like all rules, there are exceptions. For instance, if your child works for you in an unincorporated business, then they're exempt from Social Security as long as they're under 18, I think the rule is.
That's exactly right. So it's a LLC, a sole proprietorship, a partnership. If you do have a child that's working for you in the summer, then they are exempt from that rule of Social Security and Medicare tax withholding. Again, it's summertime. Let's just take advantage of this as an opportunity to help our children learn money management skills.
We always segue from money management into tax advice. And the tax advice when you have kids earning money is consider matching some of their savings with a contribution to a Roth IRA, which will compound for many, many years and hopefully end up being a nice fund for them when they get to be retirement age.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney, and this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Peggy Grinke. Peggy is the owner, founder of Legal Biz Success. Well, Peggy, how's it feel to be a business owner?
Well, it feels a bit like a roller coaster ride, which I was warned about as soon as I started the business, and it has lived up to all of that expectations.
Well, and this isn't your first venture into owning your own business, is it?
No. Back in 1996, my husband and my brother-in-law started a business called Westminster's Billiard Club in the entertainment industry down in Main Street.
But this business is a little different than entertainment, isn't it? You're actually providing services to law firms?
Yes, I am providing kind of outsourced as needed services for law firms in the area of operational management, business development, and HR management, helping them become more profitable in the end.
In this business, are you typically going to work with smaller law firms that maybe don't have enough resources to hire someone like you full time?
Yes. I identified this niche of a business about 3 years ago when the idea first took place, and I had acquired a passion for helping solo small firm attorneys, and that's where I'm going to focus.
Well, and you've got a background in the legal business. You worked at one time with the Bar Association and then also with law firms.
About 10 years ago, I started in the legal community as director of membership at the Bar Association, and I developed a passion for really helping those solo small firm attorneys. And I took it from there to actually managing a law firm, a mid-sized law firm, then working with a smaller law firm, and then I jumped into the world of doing this as a full-time business.
Why did you decide to do this as an outsourced person rather than go work for another law firm?
I saw that it was a perfect business model. What was happening in the world of legal, 50% of the people graduate from law school are going to start their own practice. So there was a real need for these people coming out to have help with the business side of their law practice.
Well, what are some of the things that you help a typical client with?
I go in typically and look at five different bucket areas, if you want to call them that. The biggest link is in the accounting financial side of it, which I'm sure you can adhere to as well. Looking at their financials, are they profitable? Helping them with pricing their services, billing and collections, HR management, helping them make good hires with talented people, and putting a lot of systems in place, which is really where my IT background comes in place, because my goal is not to be in there forever. My goal is to get in there, put systems in place, and then let me go to the next client.
You know, it seems to me that lawyers, much like doctors, when they're in law school and doctors in medical school, they don't typically take business courses. So they don't really know how to run a business. They know how to practice law. They know how to read law, but they're not versed in the things that you've done.
That's true. I see that a lot in the accounting side, talking about P&Ls and GLs and running reports and understanding the profitability model is really not what they want to focus on. They want to focus on helping clients.
What's probably the most important advice you would give someone who's starting a law practice right now, or really any small business like that?
My advice would be is to start with some short-term goals and develop that niche. What do they enjoy doing? And if you enjoy doing it, they'll be successful. And start with a good foundation.
People want to contact you. What's the best way to get you?
You can find me on social media, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, and on Facebook. And I also have a website, Legal Biz Success.
This is Tom Cooney. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney, and this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Peggy Grinke. Peggy is the owner and founder of Legal Biz Success. I know with Legal Biz Success, as the name would imply, you work with lawyers, with law firms, and typically with smaller firms.
Yes, I focus mostly with solo attorneys, and the small firm attorneys with up to five attorneys seems to be a good target area for me.
And I would imagine that small law firms like that, the attorneys are probably so focused on their cases and their clients and building their business, you know, acquiring clients, that they don't have a lot of time to spend on the actual administration of the law firm.
It's a challenge for them. They want to do what they enjoy doing, which is practicing law. They don't want to be worrying about billing and invoicing and collecting, and am I overpaying expenses? I could actually quote it and get lesser for something. So I like to come in and from a big point of view, look at the whole processes and see where I can help save money, increase the profitability.
The good news is it's easy to start a law firm because of technology. You don't need all the human resources that you used to, but you still have to have all those business processes, and somebody has to help put those in place.
And I think inside the lawyer world, getting the processes written down is probably the biggest challenge because they can get so distracted. So one of the things I'm really an advocate about is written procedures and processes and those checklists, so that, you know, there's also a lot of ethical things that you got to consider when you're running a law firm, and you want to make sure you're safeguarding yourself.
Yeah, I would imagine there's a few things that are very specific to law firms that don't apply to other businesses because of those ethical constraints.
That's true, and I think one of the biggest areas would be their trust accounting area, where there are strict rules and regulations on how those accounts are monitored and managed.
Is cash flow a big part of a law firm's business side?
It is. Cash flow is a big problem. And also pricing their services is a challenge. It's nice that I'm there for them. They have somebody to bounce it off of and get an opinion on it.
Well, and it's probably helpful that you work with other firms because you have a sense of what the marketplace is based on, you know, your direct knowledge.
In the end, the attorneys know what the gut's telling them, what's right, and I teach them to trust their gut.
What are some of the other things that you help them with? Do you even help them if they do have office personnel? Do you help them with hiring those personnel?
I do. And actually, that is an area I have enjoyed more than I thought I would. I have a deep and wide network in Cincinnati, and I have a good resource to talent out there. So I can help them find paralegals or young associates.
You know, you told me that half of the graduates from law school will be starting their own business. Is that because there's just not enough jobs in law firms for all the law school graduates?
That's a true statement. I also feel that the whole business model of law firms is changing in general. There's a more of an entrepreneurial spirit, I think, in this generation, as you see them coming out of school, and you probably see it with your clients as well, that these kids really want to come out and start their own business.
Peggy, if people want to contact you, where's the best place to do it?
Tom, I am a social media junkie, so you can find me on LinkedIn and Twitter. And on my website, Legal Biz Success is a good place.
For Business Wise, I'm Tom Cooney. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Our guests today are Tom and Chris Candelarisi. They are the founders of Plan the Way Foundation, which is a not-for-profit organization that helps families plan for their future, especially college. You know, I'm a CPA, I'm a certified financial planner, so I'm somewhat on top of my own finances, and I actually started planning for my daughter's education, who's starting college this year, when she was born, you know, several months into her life. Most people don't start that early, but when should you start?
You should really start when they're young, before right around the time they're five or six. Look at putting money away as much as you can, potentially. What we try to do is look at the people's financial situation. We always tell our clients, you know, you can't borrow any money for retirement, but your kids can borrow money and pay it off later for college. So we try to work on individuals. Basis, what they have, what they can afford to save, and where they should save it to get to maximize the best tax benefits.
You have your traditional savings vehicles, your 529 plans, your custodial accounts, your UTMAs, your UGMAs, a lot of the different savings vehicles that the financial planners are able to work with the parents on. Like I had mentioned before, though, college planning is a different niche, different process than financial planning is, because all the vehicles I just mentioned are going to be calculated and have a negative impact towards financial aid eligibility. We also incorporate a little known concept called the Be Your Own Banker concept, using a specially designed whole life insurance product that's really designed to accumulate wealth. So when we sit down with families, we know that every situation is unique. So depending upon how many students you have, the time you have before they go to college, and what risk you're willing to take will play a big part in that plan.
How do you engage your child in this process? How do you get them to take some ownership?
That's why it's been a big benefit to move it down to the junior high. So now we're hitting students 7th and 8th grade and giving them the guidance they need for entering high school. once you hit high school, if you slack off that first year, it's hard to build that GPA back up the next 3 years. So that you have a responsibility, and we stress that with the students. Your responsibility is to get good grades, is to be involved in activities, and to make yourself the most well-rounded student you can.
At what point does it make sense to borrow money for college, and when does it not make sense? In other words, no matter how expensive the college is, depending on what you're majoring in, it doesn't make economic sense to borrow?
You have to figure out, and the first thing is to determine more of the actual price, the college versus the sticker price. And I think a lot of parents and families are scared away by out-of-state schools and private schools because of that big sticker price. So the first thing is to realize how they meet that need and in what fashion, whether that's self-help or gift aid. And we have software that can provide that information for you that's not public, so that's what they get at that one-on-one consultation. But thinking about the time frame, things like that, you just always want to just be able to give yourself as much time looking at your options, breaking down the cost, figuring out what's the best fit for the student, because the last thing that you want to try to do is have the student go in undecided and they're spending multiple years, you know, trying to go after that bachelor degree, or they're transferring schools, which causes you to repeat the whole process.
It's just too expensive to use college to find yourself these days. If folks listening today would like to learn more about Plan the Way Foundation, about what you guys are doing to help families, what's your website?
Our website is www.ptwfoundation.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guests today are Tom and Chris Candelarisi, and these gentlemen have an organization, a nonprofit organization, called Plan the Way Foundation, where you help families budget and plan for the cost of college education. Let's talk about something that to me is really a huge impact, and in my mind, just a terrible thing that's happening in our society right now, and that's the ease with which young adults can get student loans. There seems to be a push, though, Tom, at least in Ohio in the most recent budget, where universities' funding in part are going to be dependent on their success in helping these students actually graduate as opposed to just getting these kids in the door.
Well, I think that's going to be a hard thing to push through, and I don't know what kind of an impact it will have with the universities because of the fact that it's affected by the students transferring, and that's a common occurrence. So if they transfer, it doesn't impact your university at all because they're not graduating. I think what's going to happen is nothing's going to change in the right direction as long as people accept all the constant yearly tuition raises and the colleges are at capacity and more. Why change? It's just like owning a business. Why change if you're successful in making money? And they all seem to be doing that.
Well, it is pretty astounding how much tuition has risen, you know, from the time I went to college to now. I mean, it's far, far in excess of inflation or any other conventional measure.
To me, though, the issue really is the loan.
Sure.
Maybe it should be more difficult for students to be able to borrow as much money as they want.
And this is, I think, a situation that we run into a lot with parents when we talk to them about how their plan is to pay for college. You see borrowing, the students taking out money to borrow to pay for school seems to be a big part of a lot of people's plans. But like you said, it's changed a lot in the costing the last 10 years. So I think a lot of times parents have the mindset that, well, I paid for college, I took out loans, my student can do the same thing without regard to exactly how expensive schools are. Now, unless you have some type of financial need based on your FAFSA form, you know, you can only qualify for true student loans through the Perkins or Stafford program. And that's only, even at max, would be up to about $7,500 in your junior and senior year. So we're talking about students looking at private loans. And that process is very much more complicated. To your point, I mean, you said it's easy to get those student loans, but I don't think students realize the implications that it takes or what happens, the consequences for missing repayments, what that can do to your credit score. And like you said, with the student loan debt that's out there hitting the trillions of dollars, surpassing credit card debt, you know, it's putting a crutch on first-time home buyers and really kind of slowing down the economy. So we're kind of stagnant in that regard. So, you know, student loans is a very big problem and something that needs to be addressed.
Well, and I think a lot of students, just like a lot of adults, think that if they can borrow money, then it's okay to borrow it. And they think someone else is judging their ability to pay it back, when really they should be judging the ability based upon what their future earnings are going to be.
And I think that we're trying to really address the issue through our Reality City program, helping students really understand that if this is the amount of money that you're going to make in the future, do you have the capacity to live the lifestyle that you want? Can you pay off these student loans? You need to really, students these days, and that's why it's so important in 7th and 8th grade, that they at least start thinking about their career to see if there's going to be job opportunities when they graduate, and to see, you know, what kind of salary they're going to be making so they do have those opportunities to pay down those loans.
And if folks listening would like to learn more about Plan the Way Foundation, the Reality City program, what's your contact information, Chris?
You can find information on our website at www.ptwfoundation.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney, and this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Molly Wellman. Molly is a self-taught mixologist who has actually written a book called Handcrafted Cocktails, and she's also the co-owner of three local establishments here in Greater Cincinnati, Japs Since 1879, Neon's Unplugged, and the Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar. Mm-hmm. Well, Molly, it says you're a self-taught mixologist. How did you get to be self-taught?
When I moved back from San Francisco, moved back to my hometown of Cincinnati, I needed a job, and the place where they hired me wanted me to know about classic cocktails. Just dove in and started reading old cocktail books from before Prohibition. And with that, pretty much anything I didn't know, I would do research on, and I learned it. I got a passion for it, and I still have it today. It's wonderful.
So as a mixologist, I assume your favorite drink is not vodka and tonic?
No, but I have drank that from time to time.
But with classic cocktails, which seem to be really in vogue now, and that's what you do, you mix these classic cocktails or your own variations on them?
Exactly. I love to introduce old cocktails that were popular during the 1880s and make them similar to how they were made back in that day. Now, today, the ingredients are just a little bit different than it was back in the 1880s, so we do the best we can with what we got. But inspired by those classic cocktails, I come up with craft cocktails using always fresh ingredients. I don't like to use things with preservatives. I like to come up with my own syrups and fresh herbs and fruits and all kinds of things. So, and the stories behind them.
You know, besides being a mixologist, you're also an owner of bars.
Yeah.
How did you get into the ownership end of the business?
It's kind of a funny story. I worked at many different bars and restaurants all around Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, which is was a great learning experience. And I met tons of amazing people. There's great people in this city running those establishments. I was always put into kind of like the corner, and I would work maybe 1 or 2 days a week, and they'd be like, there's Molly over there making her fancy pants cocktails. And it wasn't a bad thing. I don't want it to sound negative, but it was time for me to really have my own spot. So I partnered up with the guys who own Neon's, and they really wanted to do kind of what I've always been doing. And it was great because I was in the midst of writing my own business plan to open my own bar, but they had the expertise in business that I didn't have. I had the expertise in running a bar since I've worked at so many of them.
Sounds like a good combination.
It really is. I love my partners. They're wonderful.
And your newest establishment is called the Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar. Does that feature the Kentucky Bourbon Ale?
Well, yeah, we do carry that from time to time.
And just Kentucky bourbons?
Well, no, we have all American whiskey. That encompasses bourbon, of course. Also rye whiskey, which is becoming extremely popular. And then white whiskeys, experimental whiskeys, corn whiskeys, all different kinds of whiskeys made here in America.
So is that a big trend just in general with these kind of upscale bars where you have these sort of high-end bourbons? And
bourbon is becoming extremely popular, and especially we're right down the street
or
up the street from where most of the bourbon's made.
Well, what makes your establishments different than your typical bar or nightclub?
Well, my bartenders are very well educated. I trained them myself. We had to do about 6 months of training even before we opened. And I'll tell you, you go into the Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar, even if you are a little intimidated, don't be. My bartenders know everything. They're going to make you feel very comfortable in choosing a bourbon and something new for you to like.
For Business Wise, I'm Tom Cooney. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney, and this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Molly Wellman. Molly is a self-taught mixologist in Cincinnati. She's also written a book called Handcrafted Cocktails and is the co-owner of three local establishments, Japs, Neon's, and Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar. With these three establishments, I assume you're responsible for a lot of employment in Greater Cincinnati. How have they affected employment?
We have a lot of bartenders. Thankfully, we're very busy, and we need enough people to take care of everyone who comes in. At Japs, we have probably close to 25 employees, about 20 bartenders and then bar backs and other staff management. And a lot of those bartenders, some of them, it's their first time bartending. I hire on personality and then I could teach anyone to bartend. And then at Neon's, we have pretty much about the same, about 25 employees. Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar, I have about 6 employees, but it's a very small place. It's really helped a lot of people who want to get into the industry, and they're very hard workers. It's wonderful.
Is it challenging to have 3 different locations, 3 different places?
It can be challenging, but I'll tell you, it's more fun than anything. But I have some great managers and support to help me run the day-to-day, so I can kind of be out and about and promoting and talking about it, and then I can be there as well, and I don't have to worry about ordering trash bags and what.
Sure. Let somebody else do that, right?
Exactly. I have a wonderful team, and I'm so proud of everybody who works there. They're some of the best in the industry.
Well, what trends do you see in downtown Cincinnati in terms of nightlife?
Oh my gosh, it's getting so cool. I'm seeing, well, first of all, we have a lot of people starting to come back downtown to their downtown, their city. The more people who come down and make it the kind of city they want it to be, it will become that. We've had Japs for 2 years, and just in that time, it has changed like night and day. Seeing people really get excited about downtown, it's great.
You think that's because there's so many more people living there?
I think so. All the construction that's going on and all the condos and everything that's coming up in Over the Rhine is really neat to see. And it's kind of, I mean, I lived it in Over the Rhine 20 years ago, and I've always dreamed it could be like this.
Yeah,
so I'm so excited.
It certainly seems like it's met the critical mass. Mm-hmm. Molly, if people want to find you, where would they be likely to find you on a weekend? Which establishment?
Well, I'm usually at Japs on the weekends. Japs is kind of my baby. I'm there usually for happy hours. I work from about 4 o'clock to about 9 o'clock. And then at the Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar, which I call my little slice of heaven, I'm a big whiskey drinker. So I'm there usually on Tuesdays for happy hour. So I like happy hours because I have a chance to talk to everyone and I don't have to be like slinging really fast and everything. So I can be one-on-one with people more if I'm at happy hour.
Yeah, I can kind of tell you like to talk to people.
I do.
Well, Molly, thanks for your time and information.
Sure.
Thanks for listening to Business Wise. I'm Tom Cooney. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.